This is WMUK 102.1 FM, Music, NPR, Local Arts, and more. And joining me now is Andrew Kohler, conductor of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. And Andrew, you are conducting at 8 o'clock this Saturday a program called American Gothic, which brings to mind an image.
Which we've in fact used for our posters, yeah. Exactly right.
Very good. The concert starts at 8, as I mentioned. It's in the Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Center, with tickets available at the door. And we can point you to some more information later in the hour. An all-American program, is that what you set out to do?
Yes, and more than simply just all-American. I was thinking about this a little bit recently, and I thought, capitalism, free markets, you think of American history, all these things are very much wrapped up in innovators, which makes a certain amount of sense. That's often the sort of history we tell about ourselves. You know, it's the first person to do something, you know, and the first person to push the envelope yet further. And naturally, that's a very exciting part of the story we tell about ourselves. But within the context of music, I think sometimes we tend to boil down American music to Gershwin, who was the first to maybe fuse jazz with classical forms, or someone like Copland, I guess, who was...
Could see that coming.
Yeah, exactly. It was known for creating what sort of has become now the default American sound in music. And at the same time, there's a rich legacy of composers who tapped into older forms from before, who were more conservatively oriented, I guess you could say, well through the 20th century. And I thought this would be a wonderful chance to put together a collection of composers of music that I've loved and admired for various lengths of time, but at least for a little while now. Composers who are not always as well known, somewhat unsung, but who have written gorgeous, entirely successful works with their own unique voice, you know, but still drawing on traditions that are older. So they didn't remake the wheel, so to speak, but they've managed to definitely contribute to the ongoing conversation.
Right, and if they grew up with European art music, then of course that's what they came to love and try to emulate. And right, they didn't all have to change it into this new American form, as Dvorak perhaps had suggested.
Right, and Dvorak's suggestion was one that not necessarily everyone took. What you're referring to, of course, is the very famous story that Dvorak, who was such a successful Czech nationalist composer, was actually brought to America in the late 19th century, sort of late Gilded, or rather, I guess I should say, so sort of in the middle of the Gilded Age, America was increasingly trying to felt its power, I guess, on the world stage, and thought, well, we ought to have some kind of distinctive sound. And he came here for a few years, ended up being quite homesick, of course. But while he was here, he said, you know, you have an opportunity here to involve American Indian music and black spirituals. And if you do so, if you kind of fuse that folk music into classical forms, then you will have found an American sound. And of course, he demonstrated that with his Symphony from the New World. Not everyone took to that necessarily, although some did. And in fact, one of the first composers on our program is George Whitefield Chadwick, who was a New England-based composer. And he was one of the ones who was somewhat more receptive to what Dvorak said. He didn't exactly follow it all the time, but in the piece we're playing by him, it's one of a set of four works called the Symphonic Sketches, and they're all sort of stand alone. And this is the first of those Symphonic Sketches, called Jubilee. The second theme, to my ear, sounds like it has that slightly modal pentatonic inflection of those sources that Dvorak recommended. That having been said, of course, that wasn't the full story of you know, what American music would become. And in fact, in many ways, Copland, I think, just one generation later or so, who's writing in the 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s, he was the one who crafted this sound of sort of the Wild West, I guess. It was the story of America that perhaps we wanted to hear more. You know, it was one that was more comfortable to listen to. But all that having been said, you know, all along the way, there are plenty of people who tie themselves ever more strongly just to not necessarily feeling this strong pull to make something distinctively American or nationalized in any way, or really make something particularly new, just to sort of tie into tradition. Music has always been tied to tradition. That's, and even those innovators, you know, are you know, fusing jazz with classical forms still involves those classical forms from before, in the case of Gershwin. But these composers on this program are just interested, I think, in putting their own unique stamp, finding their own personal voice with the existing vehicles of communication. And I think they did that really marvelously.
With various levels of popular success.
This is true. So I think what you're alluding to is the fact that I've managed to do it again, where I've programmed an entire work of names that are largely unknown, but in, of course, in my personal opinion, unfairly so. In fact, as we were just discussing before we went on air, we don't even have recordings of all of them to share.
Well, that was just before you arrived. That was me running down the hall asking Jack, do we have the symphony by Walter Piston, for example? And you know, we have a couple of his symphonies, but not the complete set of a great American composer.
Well, this is exactly the issue, right? So he's someone who I think is very much respected, but who didn't steal the headlines quite the way Copland did. But in addition to the Chadwick piece, the Jubilee that I mentioned, we will also be playing the second symphony by Piston, as you've just pointed out, and I think it's an absolute masterwork. It's just a fantastic work of music, and I had the pleasure of discovering it long time ago, actually. I still played this in my youth orchestra, which is the first encounter I had with it, and I've thought of it many times since, and really am glad that I finally got a chance to program it. Piston, of course, was famously the professor of composition at Harvard.
That's funny. I think of Chadwick as Boston and Piston as administrator. That's about all I get.
Well, you know, they were sort of similar figures in a lot of ways, you know, because Chadwick was the dean of the New England Conservatory in Boston. So he was, in fact, more the administrator, perhaps, than Piston, who was directly involved in teaching music. But yeah, both were sort of, you know, the grand men of music in the Northeast in America.
Were they the same generation or?
No, they were a generation removed from one another. So Piston was born, I think, in 1894 and really sort of came of age in the, you know, 30s and 40s. That's really where he did the bulk of his composition. And Chadwick was certainly the generation before that. I think maybe 1860 he was born, something like that. So he was already around the turn of the century, kind of at the peak of his career.
Well, I interrupted you as you were talking about Piston.
Oh, not at all. Yes. So Piston, he was most famous as a professor of music at Harvard, and he had many major students to in his studio, like Elliot Carter and Leonard Bernstein. They were both studied under him. He's still very well known, perhaps most well known, which I think might be part of the, dare I say, at the detriment to his reputation, as the author of textbooks on harmony and on counterpoint and on orchestration. He was a supreme master of his craft in all those arenas, is no question. And sometimes, perhaps because he's so capable in all those ways, his music has been accused of a kind of dryness, you know, a sort of formalism and academic slant. But that's one of the reasons why I love the Second Symphony so much, because I think that really blows that perception out of the water. It's in three very tautly argued movements. It's very very compact symphony. It clocks in at only about 26 minutes. And it was written during the Second World War. So at the time, some people sort of heard this, warlike sounds in it. But I don't find that a particularly convincing interpretation, I must confess. There are a few elements of it, perhaps, that can seem like they relate to the war. But I think Piston was not necessarily a composer who immediately wrote about his experience or something like that, you know. Or if he did, it was in a relatively abstracted way. Nevertheless, it's a profoundly impactful work, and the first theme of the first movement is gorgeous and mysterious. Starts in the low strings alone, just as one arching line. The second theme, as the critic Michael Steinberg put it, he's the late great Michael Steinberg, I should say, who wrote program notes for the Minnesota Orchestra and San Francisco Symphony, among others. Says the second theme betrays the stamp of Made in America a little bit more obviously than many of Piston's creations. And it has this great, very sharply contrasting to the first theme, jauntiness, sort of jazz-like rhythms. It's great and has a lot of energy. Skipping over the second for a second to the third movement, that has perhaps the most sort of forward motion. It starts with this a rim shot in the snare drum, which sounds exactly as the name would imply, like a shot, and these very energetic strings, and then this very muscular line in the horns and cellos. And it's the shortest movement by far. It's only about 6 minutes, and it has this incredible propulsive energy the entire way through. But I think it's really the second movement where Piston is at his most inspired, and it's this incredibly languid, bluesy sort of tune for the clarinet, and it just arches over the entire movement, and there are these two big climaxes in the middle that kind of grow in tension, but then also resolve in this wonderful way that brings you back to that languid, tranquil opening of the clarinet. It's a really fantastic work, and I hope people will take the opportunity to come hear something that doesn't get played that often, that isn't known nearly well enough.
You must have a clarinetist who's very happy about this concert.
Yes. There are lots of wind parts generally in the program this season that I've been able to make many of my wind players happy with.
As an orchestrator, Walter Piston, is he of the school of Rimsky-Korsakov and Ravel with these miasmas of color, or more and more clear, using the orchestra as a chamber ensemble that you might hear in Shostakovich? Or
I would say probably the latter camp. He also spent some time studying in Paris, so he kind of would have had that maybe that closer channel to the Boulanger school. You know, Nadia was this famous teacher in Paris and taught Copland as well. So, but definitely the score has that modern orchestra sound to it, which is to say that there are very clear textures, and everything comes out rather brilliantly. And this is just a small aside, but one thing that I can't believe, but I think speaks a lot to Piston's personality, is that the score that I'm using and the parts, they're all handwritten by Piston himself. His manuscript was so incredibly beautiful and neat that he had no need for anyone to transcribe it, you know, or rewrite it, or even set it and print it, as most composers do. I mean, the score is just beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely lucid and easy. I mean, very rarely, for those of you who read music yourselves, you know, handwritten scores can often be a real mess, but this one is just perfectly laid out. I mean, the man really knew what he was doing to every detail.
Wonderful. And the symphony, that's the symphony that will close the program on Saturday.
Exactly right. And the Chadwick that I described, which is just, it's really is our concert opener, really. And it's just such a beautiful and lively work, as the name would imply, Jubilee. It's based on this poem that's only, the author of whom is only indicated by initials, so I haven't been able to figure out who exactly wrote this. But it basically just says something like, you know, no cool gray tones for me. I want to paint my jubilee with cornets and tambourines. So it's evocative of a celebration. And the first theme has this great energy. The contrasting theme, as I mentioned, has this slight modal inflection that makes it sound possibly like it's derived from a folk source. It ends with a great big sweeping bang. And it's a very exciting work, and I think a really nice celebratory way to begin this concert.
A reminder that the Kalamazoo Philharmonia is in concert Saturday night at 8 o'clock in the Dalton Theater in the Light Fine Arts Center at Kalamazoo College. And more information is available by calling the music office, 269-337-7070. I'm talking to Andrew Kohler, if you just tuned in. He's director of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Well, the piece I want to go to next actually doesn't involve the rest of the anything but the strings of the orchestra.
Exactly right. Yeah. So this is the work that will start the second half and that'll go with the Piston. And it's by George Walker. Now, George Walker is, to the best of my knowledge, still alive, and he's had quite a long life. I think he was born in 1922. But this is actually a rather early work from him. And he draws a lot of parallels to another composer we're going to be discussing shortly, Samuel Barber. So some of the parallels are that George Walker was a graduate of the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia and studied with the same teacher as Samuel Barber did. He also was a winner, as in fact was Piston, of the Pulitzer Prize. And he was actually, I should point out, the first African-American composer to win the Pulitzer Prize for a piece called Lilacs. And then finally, the last parallel is that Barber is perhaps most famously known for his work Adagio for Strings. And that comes from an early string quartet, and he took the slow movement of it and then just sort of rewrote it for string orchestra. And this piece, the lyric for strings by Walker, has the same genesis. It was an early string quartet that he wrote. This was the slow movement of it. And it was so successful that he sort of excerpted it out of the quartet and rewrote it for a string orchestra. In some ways, perhaps, you can even say that the Barber Adagio for Strings and this Walker lyric for strings have somewhat similar sensibilities. They've got this kind of unknowable sense of melancholy. It's not directly tragic or maudlin in any way, but there's something sort of ennobling and yet wistful about it. The way the piece begins is sort of it's all sort of just rising and falling scales. That's really the major impetus for the melodic material of the work. Very, very simple. Beautifully done, though. Passed around various instruments in the orchestra, so one never really hears. It's not like it's dominated, for example, by just the first violins playing the melody the entire time. They'll have it for a bar. They transfer to the seconds, to the violas, to the cellos back. And again, everyone sort of has one bar in this one long continuing melody. But the first gesture that begins it is basically the descending part of that scale, but it's sort of spread out very slowly. So you hear it kind of in this tectonic pace at first, and then it sort of swings into a slow but flowing motion. It contrasts with this opposing moment that feels very much like stasis. You'll hear it after all this flowing music, it all of a sudden comes to a stop, and all the orchestra plays these chords together that sound very hollowed out. I tend to think of it as sounding almost as if someone is at a loss for words for a second, you know? The flowing starts again, and it picks up quite a bit, and then we get to a really vehement climax. It's really quite towering and imposing, but doesn't last too long, and eventually we'll return to the warmth of these flowing scales. It's a really gorgeous, affecting work, and I can't for the life of me imagine why we don't hear it more often.
George Walker's Lyric for Strings, and I'm with Andrew Kohler, conductor of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, and he's conducting a program called American Gothic featuring this work. And Andrew, I'm really glad you compared it to or drew a line between this and the Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber, and I think it's absolutely appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, I really do feel that the two works share a kinship, although that's not too... I should also be careful to avoid the danger of only comparing lesser known works to greater known works, you know. Certainly the Walker, I think, stands on its own.
It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. What
it really
a treat.
Is. Yeah.
And you were talking about how lucky your wind players have been this year. Well, now this is a work in which the string players get to feel their kinship with their fellow string players.
That's exactly right. Yeah, they get to be the stars for this one, that's for sure. And it's also a nice opportunity, you know, sometimes to clear some extra space on the stage, so to speak, you know, and just get one set, one portion of the orchestra. And really, you know, the core of the orchestra, the string section is the core of any orchestra, really working together on something that, I mean, this piece is has its difficulties, that's for sure. But it's also lyricism and pace make it much more straightforward, and it's something that we can hopefully address, you know, some more subtle skills of listening to one another and
Absolutely.
Ensemble and those kinds of skills.
It's always exciting when there's a lot of notes on the page and you just have to get through them as best you can, you know, right. Play fast, fast, fast. But this, I think the word kinship sticks with me because you really can join with your neighbor on the stand and throughout the entire ensemble. And suddenly you feel like you are sharing the same brain and moving together.
That's right. And there's a lot, as you heard in this particular piece, there's a lot of flexibility. I mean, it's not sort of, it's definitely not a march, you know? I mean, there's this great, very organic flow from slower to slightly faster to pushing still faster and then suddenly pulling back and all these kinds of different tempi that sort of very organically run through the course of the work. And that's all something that has to be felt unanimously.
Does Gothic have any real resonance in the music, or is it a convenient?
It was merely meant to suggest, because the Gothic period happened so long ago and was a historical period that that itself influenced the Romantics in the 19th century in a way, that these were American composers who were reaching back towards the past or embracing the past. So it was just a semi-pithy phrase, I guess, or, you know, an allusion to the artwork by Grant Wood, as you point out, that I hoped would connote the idea that these are American composers, of course, but American composers of a sort that embraced the past and were not necessarily trying to remake the wheel.
Just before we move on to the Barber Concerto, I wondered if you'd heard many other pieces by George Walker, and does he keep that lyric style, or is he more widespread?
There's definitely a wider range of styles in his music. I think there is a fundamental lyricism, and I confess that I do not know a lot of his output, but what other things I've heard a little bit of, I think there are a lot of that lyricism is still there in a lot of his other works, although there are certainly more folk-inflected kinds of musics that he writes, as well as somewhat more modern things. He's, of course, lived a very long life. So,
Samuel Barber is the most famous name on the
absolutely
program.
I think unequivocally, yeah.
And yet he had his ups and downs too.
Absolutely. I mean, he was a composer writing in a time, of course, when his style was already seen as old-fashioned. I mean, this is exactly kind of what I'm getting at with this American Gothic. I mean, he would have seemed like a real relic of the past. He, like Rachmaninoff and like Sibelius, were writing at an interesting time in music history where, you know, the split between what was publicly popular and what was considered sort of the proper thing for a composer to do by those in the profession was splitting farther and farther apart. So whereas Barber often met with a good amount of public success with his works, he was often thought of as just hopelessly old-fashioned and so out of date. Same thing. I mean, Sibelius is a very close parallel, at least in his perception. I mean, I don't think they're very similar composers. I just mean in terms of him still being tied to this older symphonic tradition that a lot of people thought had expired by then. So, you know, you had some people talking about Sibelius being the world's greatest living symphonist in the 30s, and a Schoenberg pupil, René Leibowitz, published a pamphlet called Sibelius, the worst composer in the world. In fact, I don't even think it was a question mark. I think it was a period, the worst composer in the world. And so, you know, just great, intense opinion splits on composers. But then as now, you know, when especially now, perhaps we can say when those debates seem a little distant and somehow much less important, we can focus just on the music itself. We recognize that Barber was just a towering composer and a composer of such intensely expressive power that it really didn't matter what era he was writing in. It's something that communicates to an audience and speaks in a very direct and very moving way.
With Samuel Barber, I believe it goes way back to his early childhood. He was writing songs, you know, at the age of 11 or 12. And
he came from a musical family as well. I think his, I want to say aunt or something like that, was a very well-respected singer in the Metropolitan Opera. So, yes, I think he was always exposed to great music from an early age.
And just followed that inner voice his whole life.
I think so. You know, I mean, later in life, he did have some music that was, he experimented with serial, that is to say, 12-tone techniques and more dissonant music. But I think that lyricism is something that, I think that song-like quality is something that never really escaped him. And it was very much a part of him as a person, as a composer. And I think he was right to not cast that aside, because it's clear that resonates so beautifully in his music.
I'm not alone in absolutely adoring this violin concerto, Samuel Barber, and you can't help but hear it and assume it was a huge success. I mean, like a big hit.
Well, it was very shortly after the premiere, but getting to the premiere, there was quite a lot of tension, of course. Barber had a relatively young dedicatee in mind for the piece, and he, as I mentioned earlier in the program, was a graduate of Curtis. So was this violinist he was writing for. So, by the way, is the violinist who will be performing it this Saturday, Minghwan Xu, who now lives in Chicago. Is married to a wonderful pianist named Winston Choi, and who has two beautiful twins now at home, is also a Curtis graduate and a fantastic violinist, and has a really wonderful teaching and performing career. It was for a little while also the violin teacher at GVSU, actually, but decided, because her husband was still based in Chicago, that for family reasons to move back there, of course. She's tremendous, and I think it'll be a great pleasure for our audience to hear her perform this magnificent concerto. But back to the story of the genesis of the concerto. So Barber wrote, this is a three-movement concerto, as is typically the form of a concerto, and he had written only the first two movements, which were both absolutely classic Barber. I mean, just sumptuous lyricism from start to finish. And the dedicatee really rather loved the two movements, but his teacher said, that is to say, this violinist's teacher said, okay, I guess they're nice, but where's the virtuosity? I mean, there's just so much beautiful singing in this in these two movements, but there's not enough showy stuff. So Barber relented and wrote a holy terror of a last movement. It's about 4 minutes long, and it's a perpetual motion, and it is just for both the orchestra and the soloist just nonstop difficulty. And here the popular version of the story is that the violinist sort of blanched at this point and said, well, now it's not possible to play. In fact, it looks like the correspondence was a little bit more along the lines of, this very short last movement doesn't seem to properly relate to the other movements. And in fact, there is something of a disconnect, but again, the music is so wonderful that after it was premiered, everyone loved it so much, it became one of the most popular concertos of the 20th century. In fact, I think it is the most frequently performed 20th century concerto right now. And so, as they say, the rest is history, really. I mean, everyone got used to the work as it was, with these slightly unusual proportions. And whether or not you're listening to the sort of furious pace of the last movement or the more classic sort of Barber-like lyricism of the first two movements, it's all just a wonderful music. I mean, Barber's entirely successful in every part of it.
Let's take a break and listen to the first movement. And we'll start with the lyricism, and we still will have a little time left for this demonic last movement. This recording featuring Hilary Hahn and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. From the concerto by Samuel Barber. He only wrote one, sadly. That's Hilary Hahn and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And if you've just tuned in, we're listening to this work. It's on the program this Saturday with the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. And Andrew Kohler, my guest, is conducting the work. The soloist again
is Minghwan Xu.
Minghwan Xu from Chicago, and a graduate of the Curtis Institute, where...
Correct. As well as Northwestern, where we met for the first time.
Oh, so you go back a ways.
We do, yes.
And Samuel Barber, of course, famously... Did he ever teach at the Curtis Institute?
That's a great question. I don't believe so. I don't think that he ever taught there. He was just a famous graduate of the institution.
Strongly associated with...
Very much so, yes. And he grew up in Westchester, just outside of Philadelphia, so I think he was always sort of a native Philadelphian.
Well, I think you set up that music perfectly. I mean, describing its lyricism, that's where it lives.
And if you can believe it, what we're going to skip over now is the second movement. And I dare say that that has an even more enchanting tune. It's really, it very much channels the second movement of the Brahms Violin Concerto in that before the violinist even enters, the oboist has this incredible star turn as sort of the grabbing the spotlight and playing this gorgeous, arching, very slow, somber melody. And then finally the violinist comes in and actually does something else differently for a little while, but then returns to that melody. But that maybe is the single most beautiful melody in a work that has several competitors for the title of most beautiful.
The full program this Saturday is an all-American program, starting with a work by George Whitefield Chadwick, who's the earliest composer on the program, going back to the late 19th century. Then we hear the Barber Violin Concerto, then the beautiful lyric for strings by George Walker, and finally the Symphony No. 2 by Walter Piston. You know, Samuel Barber's concerto is right up there with his most popular and most heard works, along with the Adagio for strings. As a conductor and someone who's looked into lots of music, what are some of the other things we should be listening to by Samuel Barber that you really appreciate and think maybe need more exposure?
Well, I'm certainly no expert on the music of Samuel Barber, but there is a piece that I did recently with the youth orchestra, perhaps 2 or 3 seasons ago, called Music for a Scene from Shelley. And that's a somewhat lesser known work, but I think is really, really beautiful and really, really intensely effective.
He wrote a lot of, or a good handful of short, they're not called overtures. Some of them are called essays.
And, that's right. Yes, he's got 3 essays for orchestra. I think 3 essays for orchestra. That's right, in the First Symphony. The First Symphony is also a very compact, very forcefully argued work, but really beautiful. The First Essay is another piece that I love very much and that I know reasonably well. And of course, this is certainly not delving into the obscure canon by any means, but there is a small work for chamber orchestra and soprano called Knoxville Summer of 1915, and that I think many people already know, but for good reason, that really is a particularly gorgeous work by Barber.
It seems quite related to the music we just heard.
I think so.
And he wrote other concertos as well. We have John Browning playing the piano concerto.
Piano concerto. There's a cello concerto as well. Yeah.
Cello, yeah.
They're a bit thornier than this violin
they
concerto.
They are. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but maybe it was toward, the time when he was trying to meld his lyricism with modernism.
I think so, yes. I mean, and in the same way that I was describing Walker's later career, I mean, these are both composers who lived a long time and had a lot of time to let their language develop. But I think both stayed with a fundamental lyricism to the way that they wrote.
Well, before we listen to the final movement and I ask you about why it's so tough and difficult, do you have any final thoughts on this Saturday's concert?
Well, just that I hope people come to hear this, as always, of course. And there's this premium placed on innovation, on being, sort of stealing the headlines of music history by being the first one to do something. And that often, especially in the 20th century, doesn't always relate to works that communicate very directly with audiences. This is music that, though it's lesser known, hasn't necessarily always stolen those headlines, is music that I think really communicates well with an audience. It's music that I've loved performing in my life and that I've for a long time wanted to assemble on a program and put together. And despite the perhaps absence of really big names apart from Samuel Barber, I hope people will come to hear it because it is my hope that they will be pleasantly surprised by the beauty and the power and the communicative essence of these musics by Piston and Chadwick and Walker.
And after this Saturday's concert, you'll be on to the next thing. What are some performances and concerts you're looking forward to in the next few weeks and months?
Well, the Junior Symphony will get to play side by side with the Kalamazoo Symphony in March. I believe that's on the 22nd, and they'll be doing Pines of Rome. So that'll be an exciting opportunity for my young friends to mix forces with colleagues in the symphony.
It's a tough piece.
It's a very tough piece, yes. I'm sure that we've been working very hard on it, and thankfully the Kalamazoo Symphony is there to guide us through it. In the coming months beyond that, there's another wonderful work with the Junior Symphony. We're doing Dvorak Eighth Symphony in April, which is a work that I just adore. I just think it's one of the most the sunniest and happiest and warmest and most perfect piece I can imagine, as well as the Elgar Cello Concerto First Movement with a really tremendously gifted young cellist, one of many we happen to have in the orchestra right now, named Cullen O'Neill. And then finally, I'm really excited on June 1st, the Bach Festival and my Philharmonia Orchestra will join forces for a really ambitious program. We're doing the Cherubini Requiem in C minor, another not well enough known work, but that I think is really powerful and beautiful, as well as two big excerpts from the full ballet by Ravel for Daphnis and Chloe. And we will be getting to use the original chorus parts as Ravel intended, but many people omit because it's just a little bit too much work to get the chorus there. But of course, we've got one with the Bach Festival, and I just couldn't be more excited for that collaboration. It's a pleasure always working with those singers and the great work that Jim Turner does.
Very exciting. All of this can be found at the Kalamazoo Philharmonia website, kazoo.edu/philharmonia, as well as kjso.org for the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra events. Okay, Moto Perpetuum, what's this all about?
Well, exactly what it sounds like. It just doesn't stop. It's unrelenting. It is just a series of triplets, basically, from the start to the finish of this four-minute work, and they jump all around the violin, and they are, I'll be perfectly honest, pretty awkwardly written. They're just very hard to negotiate in a lot of cases, and it's just got this incredible driving propulsive energy. And then at the very end, just when you think there's been enough of this fast stuff, Barber sort of turns it up to 11, and now there's 16th notes, and you have to go even faster and fit in more. It's a completely thrilling way to end the concerto, and even if some initially found it not fitting with the other movements, it's nevertheless an awfully exciting way to hear this music.
I'm thrilled, as always, to have had you as my guest this morning. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, Kara. Thank you.